Do you ever worry about your kids growing up and not wanting to leave home? Or maybe not being able to leave home? Maybe this isn't your situation, but you have a friend who has an adult child who just won't leave home. Well, we're going to talk about that today, and my guest is Bruce Sheridan, and he's written a fabulous new book called A Well-Launched Life: How Young People Can Live an Intentional, Fulfilling Life. Bruce was born in Union City, New Jersey. He was the fourth of eight kids. And while he was growing up, Bruce endured a tremendous amount of abuse from his father. He went on to be very successful. He worked for General Electric and Bank of America for many years. And after he left, he became an entrepreneur and he started a coaching business. So if you need business coaching, he's your go-to guy. His story is inspiring and he knows what he's talking about because Bruce, after having a tough childhood, went out and became very successful. Let's get to my interview with Bruce right now. Well, Bruce, I am so excited to talk to you about your book, A Well-Launched Life, How Young People Can Live an Intentional, Fulfilling Life. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast to talk about it.
Thank you for having me.
You have a remarkable story, and this book is packed with so much information, and it spans a long period of time. And I know we're not going to have the chance to talk about all of it, but I do want you to tell people, you know, in the beginning of your book, you talk about the hard life, the hard beginnings. Can you dial back and tell us what life was like for you as a young person? And then, because I think that's important in how you got to writing this book.
Yeah, sure. Well, I grew up in Union City, New Jersey. It's right across the river from Manhattan in New York City. And if you go online and Google, you'll find Union City and all the little cities around it. They are the most densely populated cities in the United States.
Wow.
They have been for years. So that's how I grew up, very densely populated. My dad's dad was an abusive father, and then my father was an abusive father. So growing up in our household was terrifying. Mm. And then also living in the neighborhood we lived in was terrifying. Because I would have a fight at school or in the neighborhood almost every week or two.
Wow.
So just constantly, you're in fear. But as a child, you're born into it, and that's how you live. So you're not sure, like, oh, this isn't normal. It is normal.
Mm-hmm.
So I just look back and think of how stressful that was. And my mom, too, because my dad was physically and verbally abusive with me and my siblings and my mom as well.
Mm.
But I could tell back in those days, there was really no outlet for my mom. I felt like at least five times she was right on the edge of walking out with us, the children.
Mm-hmm.
And we would be saying, Mom, let's go.
Mm-hmm.
But as a mother, she knew there'd be no support. She would have no money. Where would she go with six kids? So it was pretty hard.
She was stuck. She was stuck.
Yes.
So how long did this last? Did this last from the time you were very young till the time you left home?
Yes.
Or was this just a period of time, the abuse?
No, it was, even years after I left home. My mom, I lived in Charlotte, North Carolina for 17 years. And one day, I'm, out in the yard playing with my kids. I have four boys. And my mom pulls up. Like, Charlotte is 10 hours from New York. And my mom pulls in the driveway.
Hmm.
And I'm thinking, what in the world? So I rush over and she's crying so hard. We get in the house. She shows me she has a knot on her head that's split open. And I said, what happened? She goes, Dad punched me in the head.
Hmm.
And I called the local police back in New Jersey because it was always like, don't say anything, don't do anything. I called the local police. And I,
who would say don't say anything or don't do anything?
My mom would say that. So I called the local police where my dad's still back in Metro New York area. And I called the city police in the city we lived in. And I filed a report and they went to the house and told my dad, we're putting you on notice that if you ever strike your wife again, you will go to jail.
Mm.
So as far as I can tell, he never did strike her again. So that was...
Did she go home?
Yeah, she did, eventually. Yeah, she did, yeah.
Mm.
But after that, you know, they would still yell at each other. My dad passed about 4 years ago. My mom's still alive. She's 93. But he was kind of, you know, I forgave him, though. But I think Jesus coming into my life is what gave me the power to love him and forgive him.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any happy memories of your childhood?
Yeah, sure. I had so much fun with my siblings. Being that densely populated, there was always, like, if you had a, you know, a bunch of friends that you're running around with and they get tense, you just go to a different group because there were so many kids all over the place. One thing that sticks out, every summer, we would go to the beach for 2 or 3 weeks every summer.
Mm.
And that I remember. And I also think my grandfather, my mother's father, just he was the most important man in my life. He was so kind and so loving and just loved me beyond measure. And I'll never, to me, that was powerful.
Do you think he knew what was going on in the home?
Yeah. But again, what do you do? I mean, my grandparents lived in a two-family home. They were immigrants. My grandmother never spoke English.
Mm.
So I think they knew. But my dad was, part of him was, he knew. He knew it was wrong. Because when I turned, about 16 years old, I was starting to mature. I was lifting weights. I was an athlete. I was on the football team and the track team in high school. And he struck me, and I just stood there, and he struck me again, and I stood there. And I think he realized, wow, that had no impact. Mm-hmm. And I just looked at him, but he never struck me again after that day, and he never struck anyone when I was in the house.
Wow.
So I finally physically got big enough where, and I knew it too. That was a turning point, because I knew after that, if he ever struck me again, I would have just knocked him on the ground. I had no desire to hurt him back, but I would have definitely, I would have never let him strike me again.
I think that
at that point,
for a lot of young men, having an abusive dad is hard because you get to the point where you can physically take your father down, but that's a horrible thing to do as a son to a father. And from the boys I've seen, it's just a huge struggle because they don't want to, and yet they want to protect everybody else in the family. So
at least he got the message, like, I can't strike him anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But I think is equally important from the physical was the verbal, because he would constantly tell me he wished I wasn't born. Ugh. He wished I was dead. He hated me. He didn't tell me he loved me till about 6 months before he passed. It was,
wow.
He passed when he was 88. And I remember visiting him in the hospital room, and we had a great chat. I always said to him, I love you, but he would act like he didn't hear anything.
Yeah.
I was leaving the hospital, and he said, I love you, and I stopped. And I absorbed it. And I realized he hadn't said that in my entire life. And I actually relished it. And I said, I love you too, Dad. And then as I was leaving the hospital, I was crying.
I bet.
It was like, wow, finally.
Isn't it amazing that the pain inflicted on you as a young boy hit you so hard as a grown man?
Yeah. Well, so many times writing my book, I had to stop because I was crying so hard I couldn't write anymore. So I'd have to come back.
I want every father out there who's listening to this podcast to hear what you just said, because a father has such a huge impact on the emotional and physical and mental health of their kids. And I don't think they have any clue how large that impact is. Do you think your dad knew?
Well, he knew how to hurt me. I'm not sure. I don't think he knew how badly he was hurting me. Because he was fighting his own battle.
Right. And he was doing what he knew.
Yes.
You know, he was reliving what he knew. Well, I want to move forward because we could talk about that for the entire podcast. Your book is A Well-Launched Life.
Yes.
How Young People Can Live an Intentional, Fulfilling Life, which it's amazing that it came from a man like you. And that's why I wanted to, with a history of that, and that's why I wanted to, you to tell your background, because that's really extraordinary. So what motivated you to write this book? Because there was a huge leap from the time you were young, and then you struggled with addiction.
Yes.
And you really had a tough life. Fill us in with that a little bit. And then I'd like you to talk about how the book came about.
Sure. So I left to go to Georgia Tech when I was 18, and I never went back home. Mm-hmm. So I worked my way through school. I got jobs in the summer. I eventually took a job with Florida Pound Light in Miami. And that's where I met a guy, a coworker. We had 11 engineers start on the same day. They would hire in waves and just bring engineers in. And this gentleman was in my class. So I show up with $110 to my name, and this guy pulls in the parking lot with a Porsche Targa convertible. And I didn't know who he was. So we're walking in the building. I said, hey. He goes, hey. We go in, and all of a sudden, we're in the same classroom together, starting first day as engineers. And I'm thinking in my head, how could he afford that car? He just graduated from college. I'm thinking, oh, maybe his dad is rich. Well, it turns out he was in like the cocaine cartel, like the real big cocaine cartel. So we became best friends. Oh. He introduced me to cocaine. We would go out to party at bars. This was like the movies. And I remember the very first time we did, I thought to myself, if I have to chip in to pay for this evening, I'm not going to be able to pay my rent. Because it was like a big fancy bar and drinks and just party. So I said to him, I said, Rudy, do I need to chip in any money? And he goes, heck no. And he threw several thousand dollars on the bar. And I was like, oh my God, cash. I was like, whoa, okay. So then he introduces me to, he says, do you want to do cocaine? This was at work. And I said, no. But then every couple weeks he would ask, and then I said to him, let's do it on a Friday at 4 o'clock so that if I freak out, I can kind of cut out and nobody's going to know. So we did. And it's a powerful drug. It's very addictive. So, you know, fast forward, I'm up all night, Sunday night, drinking and doing cocaine. And I have to call my boss Monday morning to say I'm not coming into work. And I was so devastated. I thought, what happened to you? And I just fell on my knees and I prayed to God. I said, God, I've learned in the Bible that, you know, you're at the door, but I have to open it. I said, I'm opening the door. I am begging you to do whatever you have to do to save my life. And nothing happened, but then I just I cried for like 2 hours because I just thought, what? I felt so inadequate and so broken, and I was disgusted with myself. So about 2 or 3 weeks later, I go to my friend's house around the block from me, and if we were such good friends that I could just walk in the door, and it was open. I go flying in. It's 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning. There's an attractive young lady making breakfast. So in my mind, I'm thinking, oh, she spent the night. So I go, hey. She's like, hi, who are you? I'm like, who are you? So my buddy comes out of his bedroom around the back, and he's got his hair all messed up, coffee and a cigarette. He's like, I need your help. I was like, what do you need? He goes, this girl won't sleep with me. So I said, why won't you sleep with him? She goes, well, I'm a Christian, and I'm not sleeping with anyone till I marry my husband. So I looked at my buddy. I go, you're on your own, buddy, because I'm not helping you with that one. I said, I like her answer. Yeah. So she says to me, are you a Christian? And I said, I'm not sure what you're asking me. She goes, well, do you believe in God? I said, yeah. She said, do you believe in Jesus? I said, yeah. She goes, do you have a personal relationship with Jesus? I said, now I don't understand that question either. She goes, well, have you ever asked him to come into your heart and have a personal relationship with you? I said, no. She said, would you like to have a personal relationship with him? And it was as if time stood still. I can remember this like it was 5 minutes ago. And it was like super slow motion. And my brain is having this internal battle, like, how can I have a personal relationship with someone that's been dead for 2,000 years? And is this woman crazy? And just all of this. It was like 1,000 thoughts ran through my mind in just a couple seconds. And it was a pivotal moment because I had to say yes or no to that question. Mm. And I said yes. And she said, will you say a prayer with me? So I prayed with her, accepted Jesus into my heart. And it was like supernatural, a bolt of lightning hit me in the chest. And my life shifted at that point. I wasn't aware of it still. She started crying. My buddy started crying. I'm like, why are you guys crying? They're like, because you just accepted Jesus into your heart. I go, well, so why are you crying? They said, these are tears of joy, not sadness. So I was like, oh, I'm still not getting what just happened. So about 3 weeks later, I never saw her again. And to this day, I don't know her name. Hmm. So I'm like, wow, I consider that like a miracle. So yep. 3 weeks later, I get a DUI. And now I get arrested. It's a nightmare. I think I'm going to lose my job. I'm going to go to jail. So it takes about 3 months. It cost me like $3,000 in the early 80s. It was an ordeal. So I get to court. Long story short, the judge dismisses the case because I was arrested by two police officers. Neither one shows up. The prosecutor said they both assured me they'd be here. And the case had papers missing. And the judge, she yelled at the prosecutor and said, if you ever come in my court this unprepared again, you will have serious consequences. And she dismissed the case. She slammed the gavel and said, dismissed for lack of prosecution. It's as if I never got arrested. If I never said a word again, nobody would ever know. So right. I didn't know that either. My lawyer turns me around and says, you see those doors in the back? You go out there and never look back. So I walk out of the courtroom thinking that the sheriff's going to get me. And then I walk out the front door. I'm standing on the stairs. I'm like waiting, no sheriffs. I get in my car and I just feel the Holy Spirit pouring over me. And I realized God answered my prayer. It took like 4 months, but I accepted Jesus from that young woman I never saw again. And it was as if I never got arrested, but I had to struggle with it for 3 months. I went to Alcoholics Anonymous and just racking my brain. How am I going to survive this? And then here I am sitting in my car, and it's as if it never happened. But God got me sober and Jesus in my heart, which I begged him to do whatever you had to do. It happened. I mean, if I tried to orchestrate that, you give me a million attempts, I would never have gotten it right.
The interesting thing is, as you're sitting here talking, I'm thinking, and you wrote a book called, you know, A Well-Launched Life, How To, but by what you're talking about, you weren't launching.
No.
So how did you get from there to the deeper knowledge of how a young person launches?
Well, I mean, I was doing everything. I had a great job as an engineer. I was just functioning. I was raised Catholic. I left home at 18. I never went to church again. So after this, I started going to church. My friend who was the apartment I went to, he was a Baptist. So I started going to church Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night. I started teaching high school Bible study. I couldn't read enough of the Bible. It absolutely shifted my life 180 degrees. So now I'm...
And how old are you at this point?
I was 25. Mm-hmm. I was 25 when that happened. So I look at that as a complete major milestone, because before I was just bouncing along, partying, you know, Friday night at the end of work was party time, and just lost. I was lost. Mm-hmm. So I think that launching my life actually started that day I fell on my knees.
Well, friends, I need to take a quick break, but don't go anywhere. I'll be right back. I hope you're enjoying my conversation with Bruce Sheridan. I am learning so much. Honestly and truly, I have been very concerned because over the past 20 years, I've seen a number of my patients grow into their adult years and have a really hard time leaving home. So this interview is particularly intriguing to me. Let's get back to my interview with Bruce Sheridan. You also, you know, talk about sort of figuring out where your life is going and what is the purpose of your life. How did you put all that together? Because I think a lot of people in their 20s don't know what the purpose of their life is. They don't know where they're going, and they're just sort of grabbing at things. And I see that, and a lot of parents will struggle with this, sort of say, you know, my son or daughter's in their 20s. They're trying different things. They don't know where to go. They don't know what they're good at. So how, through your own navigation of that, how would you help a person in their 20s? Or how should parents help their kids in their 20s find their purpose, find where their life is going the way you found it?
Yes. I'm not sure I found it immediately. And this is another interesting piece. So I came out of school as an engineer. I went to Florida Power and Light. My first 2 years was strictly engineering. But then our CEO went to Japan and saw an electric company there that was performing light years better than we were. So he came back and he said, we need to do this. And we had Japanese counselors come over every quarter. And I don't know how, at 25, I got picked to run that for the Miami division, which was by far the largest division at Florida Power and Light. So here I am, a 25-year-old in this room with 40, 50-year-old leaders, and I'm like, what is going on? So I, listening to these counselors, I start applying, you know, how do you set a strategic plan and a vision, and how do you solve problems at the root cause? How do you measure your progress? So that's what I started doing at age 25, but now, like, fast forward almost 40 years, I've been coaching leadership teams in large corporations and small businesses for almost 40 years. So 6 years ago, my son graduated college, and he, exactly what you said. I said to him, hey, what do you want to do? I don't know. Well, what is your dream? I don't know. What kind of job do you want? I don't know. So this went on for like 3 or 4 months. And I finally realized I've been coaching companies for almost 40 years, and my son is asking me all the questions about what is his strategic vision? How is he going to know he's making progress? What does he want out of life? So I said, hey, will you sit down with me at the kitchen table? He was 23. He said, sure, Dad. So I thought we were going to have a 15-minute conversation. We sat down at the kitchen table and built an Excel spreadsheet. We were there for 4 hours. And it felt like 15 minutes. That's how engaged we were. And I built this Excel spreadsheet with God, family, career, and budget. And when we were done, he stood up and said, Dad, you have no idea how much this would help my friends. Wow. Boom. That was 6 years ago. And I started Life Compass. And I started coaching young adults personally. So I just released the book March of last year, so it's been out 1 year. But my dream is to teach other adults how to coach young adults. The book is a blueprint. To me, the process is 4 steps. Think about what you want to do with your life. Write it down. Measure your progress every day. And then review it every 90 days. That's the structure that I built. My next step I want to do is build a 6-week class that churches can use with 18 to 28-year-olds, because I feel like that's almost like a black hole in church. You graduate high school and it's like, oh, I'm in a mega church. There's like 20,000 members. This is not a good program for 18 to 28-year-olds. My dream is to build that curriculum and teach other people to coach. If it's just me, I've coached like maybe 40 or 50 people in the last 6 years. But if I could teach 40 or 50 coaches, now you got a lot of coaches.
Well, you know, and I think just as important as telling kids how to launch their life and the things to go through, I think that the mere fact that an adult is willing to engage a young person and say, you can do this. I can help you. You have a purpose. You can move forward. Because I think a lot of young people now are lost.
Yes.
They feel disconnected from their families, disconnected from their parents for many, many reasons. I'm not telling parents they're horrible parents. It's the culture. Our culture pulls young people away from important relationships. And I think that's the root of a lot of the emotional struggles kids are having. But there's so many parents who have 20-somethings that are scratching their head saying, I just don't know what to do. And you're coming along and saying, well, I do. And here's what you do it. But back to what I was saying is, as important as it is for you to teach coaches how to help kids find their career and their purpose and everything, equally as important, and I mean equally as important, is the fact that we're paying attention to our young people and saying, you've got what it takes. Let us figure out what that is, this Excel sheet. Let's figure out how much money it's going to take. Let's figure out, you know, how you're going to get from A to Z. And what are your goals? And it sounds pretty easy, but it's probably a hard process because a lot of parents and coaches aren't used to talking with people 18 to 28 on that level.
Yeah. I'm on the board of directors of Urban K Life. It's urbanklife.com if you're interested in looking at it. It's an inner city group in St. Louis where we help high school kids. We have 300 to 400 a year go through. So I'll sit down with the seniors because they're 18, 19. And last year I sat down with a young lady and I said, what is your dream? And, you know, this is where my 40 years of coaching comes in. I will ask that question. And if we have to sit there in silence for 5 minutes, I'll sit there. If you don't have coaching experience, 5 seconds of silence, you feel like you have to interrupt the silence and say something. I could tell they're thinking, and I just let them go. Mm-hmm. And I'll wait till they start talking. And she said, oh, I want to be a chef. And I said, okay. I said, all right, so do you want to have a restaurant in St. Louis? She goes, no, I want to travel around the world. Now, we're talking inner city. The stories I get from these young people, I don't know how they pick themselves up every day. It's a rough neighborhood. People are murdered there. I coached 5 boys last year, and only one of them had a dad who was a drug addict that the son had to come home from school, find his dad, and drag him home and take care of his dad. So I'm thinking, okay, 4 of them that didn't have a dad, you're probably worse off than them because you got to be the dad to your drug addicted father. It was so getting back to my point, she told one of the counselors after we did our first, I try to meet with them for like 90 minutes. I think that's enough. Like you can only absorb so much. So I think 90 minutes is a perfect amount of time. She said to the counselor, please tell Mr. Sheridan that I never even considered that it was okay for me to dream. Because we were talking about, I was telling her, yeah, you could go all over the world and test food and come back with ideas. And she was like, really? I'm like, yes. Let's put that down as your dream. And I wrote her dream on the whiteboard, travel around the world, learning various foods and bringing those back and making recipes. And she told the counselor, please tell him I never thought I could dream and think about my life that way. She said, it just never entered my mind. And I am so grateful that I talked to him.
Wow. Well, and there you go. You're helping her sort of say, do you have a dream? It's okay to think about the dream. It's okay to act on that dream. You're important. You mean something. You can do this. And I think coming from a man, I'm not saying you're old, you're my age-ish, you know, but a more mature person, I think it carries more weight. We only have a few minutes left. I want you to talk to dads out there and what dads can do to help their kids. Let's say a dad has a 12-year-old or a 15-year-old. What do they need to do now to help their sons and daughters?
Well, I don't know when I saw it, but I saw this data once that said, I don't know how they even studied it, but they said that dads were spending 5 minutes on average, 5 minutes a week in a dialogue with their children. And I thought to myself, so I started paying attention after I read that. And I started to realize, oh my gosh, it's crazy. So I intentionally, because I was working, I was at Bank of America in a leadership role. I'm out of town for weeks at a time, and I'm working all hours. Some days I would leave before the kids get up and get home and they're already in bed. I made it a point to spend time one-on-one having a look them in the eye conversation with my children. I just made sure I'm not going to be a statistic where I only talk to them 5 minutes in a week. That to me is so unbelievable that that's the state that we were in.
Well, and I think a lot of dads don't realize that. A lot of dads will say, well, I have a pretty good relationship with my kid. And then I say, okay, but take inventory of your time for a week and see. And it's a shock to them. If you could go back, I want to ask all of my guests one question. If you could go back and be 13 again, what question would you ask or comment would you make to your father?
Oh, when I was 13, I would say, Dad, you had 6 children and you need to take responsibility for their lives. You brought them into this world. God gave them to you as a gift, but still he's entrusting you to treat them. We are all made in God's image. He was entrusting you to treat them in a godly manner, and you're not doing it. You need to love us and take care of us and, you know, not be physically and verbally abusive. If I could tell him that, I would.
Well, I appreciate that, because obviously we have a very different perspective as adults looking back. But I think to think about, because as a parent, as a father, if you had a 13-year-old, you would want to know what that 13-year-old wants from you or what question they would ask. And so we only learn that by asking ourselves as we get older. Bruce, this has been a wonderful time. I learned so much. I'm so inspired by you. My guest is Bruce Sheridan, and his book is A Well-Launched Life: How Young People Can Live an Intentional, Fulfilling Life. I want you, please, I want to interview you in a year, and I want you to talk to me about all of the people out there in churches or communities who are teaching your program to young people. Will you do that?
Absolutely. Thank you.
You're welcome. I encourage everybody in my audience to read it. Even if you don't have a young adult kid who needs to launch, which I don't, my kids are all gone, but the story is so inspirational and it really nails what's going on with our kids today and the problem, but you give a solution to the problem. You know, so many books don't give solutions. They just talk about a problem, but you give concrete solutions. Maybe it's because you're an engineer. I don't know, with an Excel sheet. I love that. Here's your life. Here's what you need to do. Let's write it all out. You sound like Dave Ramsey. Dave is all about set a goal. Even if you don't meet the goal, set a goal.
Yes.
And then set another goal. And so I think you think very much alike. Oh, I want to ask you. So if people wanted to find out more about you, more about the work you do, how can they get hold of you?
My website is Life Comp, because the nonprofit I formed is Life Compass, and that was taken. So it's Life, L-I-F-E, Comp, C-O-M-P.org.
LifeComp.org. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, this has been a wonderful time. I've learned so much. Bruce is inspiring. He's encouraging. And you can see after listening to him why he's such a good coach. He's the real deal, if you want. Now let's get on to my points to ponder. 1, hardship creates character. The hardship that Bruce endured as a child is abusive and inexcusable. But out of his pain, he gained tremendous strength and drive. Think of any successful person you know. Whether their success is in relationships or school or work, anything, those people have inevitably endured some kind of hardship, because it's only through the hardship that we can learn to find strength and overcome it. We parents raise our kids with the goal of keeping life neat and tidy and free from struggle as they grow up. But making life too easy for our kids doesn't help them become strong and independent. 2, don't coddle your kids. Many adult kids don't want to leave home because they feel that they don't have to. Everything they want or need is supplied for them. Why should they change? Many of these kids have been coddled, raised in a way where everything is provided for them, and they never learn to supply things for themselves or for others. Many parents confuse coddling with healthy affection. The two words are worlds apart. 3, make your child get a job as soon as he can. I'm talking about getting a job in your early teens or even preteens. When your child's old enough to work, he should get to it. He doesn't necessarily need a full-time job, but when he can start mowing the lawn or babysitting, get your kids out there working so they know how to work hard and how to manage money. It helps them understand that getting things, not just material things, requires work, and that work is good. Imagine marrying somebody who never learned to work hard. You would have a miserable marriage and probably be financially poor. So don't set your kids up for this. Help them find even a small job when they're done. They can start by doing chores around the house and eventually move in to paid jobs, even when they're young. I'd like to thank my guest, Bruce Sheridan, for sharing his wisdom and his heart and his story with us. This is going to be very hard to talk about. I strongly encourage you to follow Bruce by going to orgcompassinc.com. That's orgcompassinc.com. Or you can just Google him, Bruce Sheridan. Now let's review my points to ponder. 1, hardship creates character. 2, don't coddle your kids. And 3, make your child get a job as soon as he can. So if you want to know anything about coaching or business or helping your kids launch when they get to be adults, check out Bruce's work. Remember, that's orgcompassinc.com. And if you need encouragement or answers to any of your questions, please go to my website, meekerparenting.com. I have courses, tips, and blogs designed to help you get through this tough job called parenting. And if you know a dad who needs encouragement, while you're there, check out my brand new course, Strong Fathers, Strong Daughters Masterclass. And always remember, parents, that great kids are raised, not born.